Well, good evening, everybody. Is my mic loud enough? Can you guys hear me? Okay. Let's go ahead and pray so we can jump right into everything. If you've been to our new class before, you know I always say we have a lot to cover, so let's just go ahead and get started with prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you for this group of people that have sacrificed their Wednesday evening, whatever else they could be doing. They've decided to be here to learn more about your word, learn more about you so that we might know you better and love you more. Of course, that is my goal, that is my aim, and everything we do, that we could just see Jesus better and know him more because his love is greater than anything in this world, Lord. So help me to make things plain tonight. Help me to speak truth and to speak it accurately and to speak it humbly, and may you open our hearts to receive it. We ask all this in the name of your son, Jesus. Amen. So I imagine a lot of you have been to Renew classes before, but I always like to say these things at the beginning in case there are some of you who haven't. So just a few housekeeping things on the front end here. If you did not get a handout out there right outside the double doors, I would suggest that you get one. You can do a couple things with them. You can take notes with them. If you're not a note taker, though, that's okay as well. There's other things. As you're going to see as we go throughout the evening, there's a lot of content to cover. Too much for you to memorize, that's not the goal. But something to help you with that are there are personal reflection and application questions so that you can revisit this content in the coming weeks between now and the next Renew class. So you can look at those personal reflection and application questions. And then at the very back are resources. You'll notice they're all hyperlinks. I will post this on our website tomorrow. You can click on those hyperlinks. There's books, there's articles, there's videos, all kinds of things if you want to look into some of these things even further than we have time to do tonight. Having said that, as far as posting things online, the recording from tonight's teaching and the PowerPoint will be up online too. The recording may take a few days. Just to get the editing and things like that done. So again, lots of content to cover, so much that I want to be very cognizant of your time and very respectful of that, which means I can't stop in the middle of the teaching to answer your questions. Good news is that we will end, though, with a question and answer session. So the goal is I'll teach for about an hour or so. We'll take a 5-minute break so that you can go to the bathroom, you can freshen up your coffee, you can leave at that point if you really need to go. I'd love for you to stay. But after that 5-minute break, we'll all come back in here for a question and answer session for about 20 or 25 minutes. The point is, if at any point during tonight's teaching you have a question about something that I said that's relevant to the topic we're talking about tonight, jot down your question, jot down this phone number, and you can text it in, and that's how we'll do our question and answer session. All right? Okay, that's all of our housekeeping for now. Let's just jump right into what we're going to be talking about. So if you were here last month for the beginning of the series, or even if you weren't, it's at least worth reminding you kind of the basic idea of what we're doing. And I told you last month that this entire series of four classes this semester is founded on two claims that I'm making. So let me just remind you of those on the front end of tonight's class. Claim number one that I'm making is that everybody tells themselves a story about the world and their place in it. Claim number two is that Christianity is a true and better story. Hence, the title of this series of classes is Considering Christianity, Is It a True and Better Story? So out of those two claims, we spent most of the time last month focusing on the first one and then just began to tease the second claim at the very end. So this class and the next two classes are all going to focus on that last claim. Christianity is a true and better story. So since my goal is to show that to you, since my goal is to prove that to you to some degree or another, I think it'd be really helpful on the front end here if I just reminded you what the Christian story is. Maybe that goes without saying for some of you, but maybe it doesn't. So before we get too far, let me just remind you of how we defined the Christian story last month. We did it by looking at how Christianity answers three big questions. I'll just put them back on the screen for you to see. We asked the questions, why are we here? What's wrong with us? How do we fix it? All of us are asking those questions, even if we don't know it. We have answers to them, even if the answer is, I don't know and I don't care. These questions are important. Christianity has answers to them. The answers, in a simple form, if you want the deeper answers, you can go back to the recording from last month, but just for the sake of simplicity, the simple answers that Christianity gives are, why are we here? Because God created us in love. What's wrong with us? The answer simply is death, rooted in sin. How do we fix it? We can't fix it, but God did through his son, Jesus Christ, who became a human, died, and rose again in our place. What we're going to focus on tonight is that very first part of the story. We're going to be focusing all our attention on the question, why are we here? And Christianity's answer is because there's a personal God who actually created us. And my claim throughout the rest of tonight's material is that is a reasonable story to believe. There's evidence for it. It makes sense of our experience. It's beautiful. It's satisfying. But now it's up to me to defend that claim. So the way we're going to do it is we're dividing tonight into like two parts, and you can see this if you've got your handout. For the first probably two-thirds of tonight's class, we're going to look at positive evidence for this part of the Christian story. And then probably the last third of the class or so, what we'll do is look at common objections against this part of the Christian story. So another way to say that is we're going to spend the first part commending the faith, and then we'll spend the last part actually defending the faith. Or if you're a sports person, we'll be on the offense, and then we'll be on the defense. All right, does that all make sense? Are we all on the same page there? All right, well, let's start then with part number one of our class. Let's look at the positive evidence for this specific part of the Christian story, or otherwise known as commending the faith. So something I said to you last month, and I'll probably repeat this a lot, is that this is not a bait and switch class. I'm going to put all my cards out on the table. So I'm not going to start tonight's class with Scripture, and then look around for evidence that happens to fit my understanding of Scripture. That's one way to go about it. I'm not saying that's a wrong way. What I'm going to do instead is start with what we could call six undeniable realities, if you want to fill that in on your blank on that chart. I want to start with six undeniable realities. Now, of course, somebody could deny these things that I'm about to show you. That's possible. But I think, and I hope you'll see this as we go, you would be in the minority if you actually denied these things. So we're not starting with Bible verses. We're not starting with Scripture. The things I'm going to show you, they're not like contested historical accounts. They're not even abstract logical proofs. They're not controversial pieces of information in general. You don't have to go to a church to hear these things. You can hear them in public school classrooms, Ivy League universities, research labs. They are accepted and valued by atheists, agnostics, Muslim, Hindus, Christians across the board. So as we go through these things, I'm not really asking you to consider whether these six things are true and accurate. I actually think that's more or less a given. What I want to ask you to consider as we go through these realities is what story best makes sense of them. That's what I want you to always have in your mind as we walk our way through this. Which story about the world, the Christian story or some other alternative, makes the most sense of these six undeniable realities? And we're going to divide them into two categories. The first category is going to be three physical realities, and the second category is going to be three non-physical realities. That may not mean anything to you now, but I think as we go, you'll understand why I am categorizing them that way. One little disclaimer just to give you time to write that down. This should go without saying, but I'm not a scientist. I did not study. That's not my degree. That's not my expertise. If you dig into any of the concepts that we're going to talk about tonight, there will come a point where you'll be out of your depth because you're just not an expert in it. Maybe you are, but I'm certainly not an expert in it. But that doesn't mean that we can't reach conclusions about these things. What we can do is what people have done for centuries is we lean on people who actually are experts, trusted, qualified experts that can distill this information at a popular level. So what you're going to find, just like last class, is I'm going to use a whole lot of quotes. Actually, I had a lot more quotes and had to cut them out. I like quotes. But these are going to be quotes from trusted, respectable, highly qualified people to speak on these topics. So you don't just have to take my word for these things. All right, let's begin with the three physical realities. Reality number one that I want to put in front of you may sound simple at first, and we'll go through it. The universe had a definite beginning. The universe had a definite beginning. In the 1920s, scientists began to discover that all of the observable and measurable and mathematical evidence pointed to the fact that our universe, all of space and all of time, all of the material universe, had an actual definite beginning in time. We noticed that it was expanding instead of staying still, which implies that if it's expanding, there must have been a time where it all started at a definite point in time with a Big Bang. You've probably heard that phrase before in middle school or high school science, the Big Bang Theory. So this idea of a Big Bang, though, when it was first used, it was a pejorative term. The very first person to ever use the words Big Bang were actually using it to mock this theory. And the reason for that is because before the 1920s, most scientists actually believed that the universe was static, that it was eternal. It wasn't moving. It wasn't expanding. It had no beginning. And so when discoveries were being made that contradicted that, many scientists reacted very negatively to that evidence, so much so that they began to coin pejorative phrases for it, like this Big Bang Theory. And again, you don't have to take my word for it. Stephen Hawking, who is probably the second most famous scientist ever, right behind Albert Einstein, himself also an atheist, in his very famous book, A Brief History of Time, here's how he described that history. He said, many people do not like the idea that time has a beginning, probably because it smacks of divine intervention. There were, therefore, a number of attempts to avoid the conclusion that there had been a Big Bang. Albert Einstein was actually one of the early people to try to avoid that. Later in life, he called it the greatest blunder of his life. So this idea, though, that the universe had a definite beginning, it's not static, it is eternal, it began with some kind of Big Bang, that is now the most widely accepted standard model of the universe. And what it does is it begs two questions. What made the Big Bang go bang? And more importantly, where did the stuff come from that actually went bang? And we'll talk a little bit about this when we get down to the objections part of this class. Many scientists have attempted to come up with theories that answer those two questions. Where did the stuff come from and what made it go bang? But what you'll find if you dig into that stuff is those are exactly what they are. They're just theories. They're theoretical. A lot of them are very speculative. And most of them don't have direct, hard evidence for what they're saying. At best, a lot of these theories only describe what they think happened at the Big Bang, but they don't really explain why it happened or where it all came from. Again, you don't have to take my word for this. Let's go back to Stephen Hawking here. Same book. Here's how he put it. And he's talking about, in this quote, the attempt to find this grand unifying theory that explains everything, okay? This grand theory that will explain everything. Here's how he says it. Even if there is only one possible unified theory, it is just a set of rules and equations. What is it that breathes fire into the equations and makes a universe for them to describe? Pay attention to this part. The usual approach of science of constructing a mathematical model cannot answer the questions of why there should be a universe for the model to describe. Why does the universe go to the bother of existing? All right, that's our first reality. The universe had a definite beginning that really defies a clear, compelling scientific explanation. That's where we're starting. But that's not all. Not only did the universe have a beginning, it also seems to have a purpose or a design. And that brings us to physical reality number two, is that the universe is fine-tuned for life. The universe is fine-tuned for life. I'll give you the theoretical definition, and then we'll give you a couple metaphors so that you can understand what I'm saying here. So in recent decades, physicists have discovered, and this is not controversial, this is universal, more or less universally accepted. Physicists have discovered that there are certain mathematical constants in the universe, like the gravitational constant or the cosmological constant. These are numbers, mathematical numbers that never change. There are certain mathematical constants in nature and certain amounts of things in nature, like energy at the beginning of the universe, that fall into such an extraordinary, narrowly range of values that just a smidge difference in these numbers would not allow life to exist and be sustained on Earth. And I'm not just talking about human life, but even like microbial, bacterial life. These numbers are so narrowly, finely, precisely tuned that just like an astronomically small change in them would make life not possible anymore. If you're wondering like what in the world does that mean, let me try to like give you a more like concrete answer to this abstract thing. So imagine that our universe is this great big machine that has all kinds of dials, like the ones you see on the screen here. And then imagine that all of these dials have an infinite number of settings. You could literally turn them an infinite number of times to different settings. And each of these dials represents some mathematical constant or something like that. What I'm saying, what physicists have said, is our universe just happens to have all the dials turned to the exact value that will support life. And if even the wind were to blow on one of these dials and barely turn it, life could not exist. That's what's going on with our universe. That is a not controversial fact about the universe, which begs the question, what best explains that? Your answer could be, and this is the answer of some people, it's just an accident. It's just a random accident. It's just the way the universe is. And you could take that line of reasoning. If you take that line of reasoning, I would just ask you to consider this story, and then you'll see where I'm going with it. So you say it could be an accident. So my wife and I have been very much into the Great British Baking Show here of late. You're wondering, how in the world does that connect? I'm going to show you how the Great British Baking Show connects. Last episode we watched was Bread Week. Anybody watch the Great British Baking Show? I got a few fans. All right, maybe there'll be some more fans after night. So the last episode was Bread Week, and I am no baker, but I learned a lot in that episode about how finely tuned the conditions must be for turning out the perfect bread. I'm talking about like bread that is just airy on the inside, and it's just the crust on the outside is just perfect. It really, everything has to go perfectly for that to happen. Let me give you an example of what that might look like. So obviously got to start with the ingredients, and you mix those, which I think I could do that. But then I realized like there's actually a such thing as overmixing. I didn't know that. You can overmix something. If you overmix it, it's not going to be. If you undermix it, it's got to be exactly right. All right, so maybe I could get past that. Then you take out the dough and you have to knead it. And you have to knead that exactly right. I mean, they were stretching the dough and poking it and seeing if light would come through it. That's how precise it has to be. So then if you get all that right, then you have to let it prove. You have to let it sit and you have to let it rise. And if it rises just too little, it might, what's the answer here? It might, who knows this? It'll be dense and flat. I'm looking at my notes. This is how little I know about baking. If you let it go too long, it might collapse in the oven. But then if you put it in the oven and you think, finally, I've gotten through all this finely tuned stuff, I'll just look at the directions for how long to keep it in the oven. No, that's not how it works either. You have to know when to take this thing out. You have to like eyeball it. You have to take it out at exactly the right time. And if you do all of these things perfectly, if you do all of this perfectly, you will get a perfectly baked loaf of bread. All right. So now imagine that you take your yeast and your water and your flour, what you use to make bread, and you put it in the bowl and you set it outside on your deck. And that's it. And you walk back inside and you keep going back to check to see if you have a perfectly baked loaf of bread. Will you ever have a perfect, if you just leave that bowl outside and you just let the random forces of nature act on it, the weather, the wind, the heat, what are the chances that it's going to mix itself perfectly? What are the chances that it's going to knead itself perfectly? What are the chances that it's going to prove perfectly and bake itself perfectly? You would be right to say that will never, and that is impossible. And the point of this fine-tuning thing is, as impossible as that sounds, the fine-tuning of the universe is more astronomically precise than all of that, and therefore more astronomically unlikely. If I walk outside and I happen to see a loaf of perfectly baked bread sitting on my deck, I'm going to look around for a baker. If we look around in the universe and we see a perfectly fine-tuned universe, we look around for a designer. And that's not foolish to do so. That makes sense. And I'm, again, not the only one that says that. So I told you that the Big Bang was a pejorative term that was kind of coined by somebody that didn't like the theory. That gentleman was Fred Hoyle, who was an atheist, didn't like the theory of the Big Bang because he believed the universe was eternal. A Cambridge astronomer, very smart. Here's what he said about the fine-tuning of the universe. He said, a common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with the physics, as well as with chemistry and biology, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers that one calculates, that's all those numbers I was talking about that are finely tuned, the numbers one calculates from the facts seem to me so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question. This man, to my knowledge, never became a religious person, but he couldn't get out of the fact that the universe is fine-tuned for life. And that's hard to explain using science alone. That's undeniable reality number two. Undeniable reality number three is that life is extraordinarily complex. So we've been talking about very big things. You might say the biggest thing. We've been talking about the whole universe. Now let's bring it down to the smallest level. Well, maybe not the smallest, not the quantum level. Let's bring it down to the level of a singular cell, a singular cell of life. So I told you a few minutes ago, there was a time period where scientists used to think that the universe was eternal, but then there was evidence to the contrary, so they had to change their views. In a very similar way, there was also a time when scientists thought that life at the cellular level was very simple. But then, in 1953, there was this scientific breakthrough that made them change their view about that. And that scientific breakthrough was when Watson and Crick, James Watson and Francis Crick, famously mapped out the structure of the DNA molecule. You can see it there in the background. And what they found when they did that in 1953 is that the DNA molecule actually stores information in the form of a four-digit code that they assigned letters to there. You can see those in the background, C, A, T, and G. And the letters could be put in all kinds of different formats to present different information. So Crick himself, Francis Crick, compared this to letters written in a language or digital symbols in a computer code. So what we thought about life being simple actually turned about to be astronomically complex. Let me give you a couple of quotes just to drive that point home. So Richard Dawkins is probably the world's most famous atheist. He's also an Oxford evolutionary biologist. Here's what he said about it. He said, the machine code of the genes, talking about DNA, the machine code of the genes is uncannily computer-like. Now, he doesn't jump to the fact that this must mean there's a God, but he recognizes that it's odd. It's odd that DNA is that complex. It's uncannily computer-like. Probably the world's most famous computer guy, Bill Gates, said it this way, DNA is like a computer program, but far, far more advanced than any software ever created. Microsoft, for example, along with other companies, has been partnering with university researchers to try to figure out how to efficiently and effectively actually store data on DNA. Because everybody uses smartphones and everywhere now uses cloud storage and things of that nature, we are quickly running out of storage capacity for all the data that's out there. So they've been toying around with how can we actually store information on DNA. And it's been done on certain small scale levels. So DNA very much acts like a computer code, like a software. So again, what we're seeing here is what we once thought was very simple, life at the cellular level, is actually very, very complex. And all of that begs a question that scientifically hasn't been satisfactorily answered to this day, which is, where did the first complex digital code of life come from? Where did the very first complex digital code of life come from? We'll talk about one of the theories behind that when we get to the objection section. But for now, let me just say this, and you can look into this and push back on me in the Q&A if you want to. Scientists just don't have a really good answer for that as of yet. So Francis Crick, one of the scientists that mapped out the DNA, he was an atheist. He later called this problem of the origin of life as almost a miracle. Almost a miracle, he said. And he was so perplexed by it. He was so perplexed by how did this complex software code of life just come to us that he actually formulated a theory, and he knew he didn't have any evidence for it. His theory was that maybe an advanced civilization of aliens came to Earth and seeded life. And the reason, and it sounds funny, but his point was this needs an intelligence behind it. He couldn't make the jump to supernatural intelligence, so instead he was willing to make the jump to something in our universe. Just like a software code requires a programmer, it surely seems like the cell actually requires a designer. This is why the famous astronomer Carl Sagan, anybody watch Carl Sagan growing up? He did the TV show Cosmos. He was the host for Cosmos. He said, it's very hard. He was also an atheist or an agnostic. It's very hard to approach the question of the origin of life without coming to grips with religious sentiments of one sort or another. All right. So if we were to look back over all three of those physical realities, again, the question I want you to keep asking is, what story makes the most sense of them? Hopefully what you glean from all those quotes is even respected scientists who wouldn't consider themselves religious in the traditional sense, even those scientists are tempted by or at least see the attractiveness in a supernatural explanation. Because as of right now, science doesn't have good answers for those things. But we're not done yet. So that's the physical realities. What I want to do now is shift gears and look at what I'm going to call non-physical realities. They're not physical, but I would argue they're just as weighty, just as undeniable, maybe even more undeniable than these physical realities. So let's switch gears to those now. Maybe all the science and stuff is getting to you. Let's do something else. So let's talk about math. Everybody loves math. Boo, yeah. If math, I actually have a disclaimer written in my notes here. If math isn't your thing, if you were one of those students who said, when am I ever going to use this? Then just bear with me and sit tight. We have a couple other things that may be more up your alley. But I'll try to make this as interesting as I can make. I actually loved math in high school. And then I got in college and realized I don't know how to actually do math. So here's a question I want you to consider. 2 + 2 = 4. That's a simple mathematical law that is true and absolute. No matter where you go in the world, no matter what race of people you're talking to or language or tribe or culture, 2 + 2 = 4. That's why so many people actually do like math more than they like history or literature, because they feel like it always gives me the same answer all the time. There's no subjectivity. It's definite. All right? What if, here's a little mental experiment here. What if the entire physical and material universe collapsed on itself? Like the entire universe just went away. You and I were gone in an instant. Would 2 + 2 = 4 still be true? And the intuitive answer, even though that sounds like a weird thing to think about, the intuitive answer, and one that many mathematicians would agree with, is that yes, that would still be true, because mathematical laws at least seem to not exist only in our minds, but almost independent of our minds. Here's another way to think. I was actually talking to somebody right before the service who is studying math at UMBC, and he gave me this illustration that I'm tweaking a little bit. If we were to somehow be able to destroy all the works of Shakespeare, like actually destroy all the books, destroy all the evidence on the internet, we destroyed all the evidence of the works of Shakespeare, and the generations that are alive right now died out, the next generations would never replicate the works of Shakespeare. They might replicate other nice works that are close to them, but they would never replicate word for word Shakespeare, right? But if we destroyed all the math textbooks and all the evidence of all the math laws on the internet, sooner or later, people would still discover exactly the same laws. This is an idea referred to as mathematical realism. Math seems to be this real abstract thing that exists apart from the physical material universe. Now there are philosophers and mathematicians. I want to be very clear. I told you to put my cards on the table. There are philosophers and mathematicians that would push back against that, and they would say that's not really true. But in reality, even if they say that, they often act differently. They actually pursue their study of math like there are actual laws out there to be discovered. I'm not creating them. I'm actually discovering something that's actually out there. Now, if that's all like stuff that's way beyond how you want to think about that, think about it this way. Not only is math real, it's also beautiful and useful. Let me throw up an example to show you what I mean here. And maybe you won't think this is beautiful, but I do. A nice right triangle. Does anybody know where I'm going with this? Huh? A little Pythagorean. Are we getting like people's just like palms are sweating and they feel like they're back in school? The Pythagorean theorem, something you learn in middle or high school, it basically defines for us the relationship of the sides of a right triangle. You can square the two sides of a triangle, add them together, and you get the square of the hypotenuse. Now, what I'll say about this is two things. That is a beautiful theory. It's an elegant theory, and that's hard to put into words, but look how balanced it is. There's just something about it in its simplicity that's so beautiful. But what's even more astounding is that it works. Like, this theorem is something that is an abstract idea out there, and yet it actually has real-life consequences. This theorem is used in computer softwares and by human beings for plane navigation and ship navigation, for GPS measurements, for constructing homes and furniture. How is it that this abstract idea separated from the physical world actually has physical implications? What story makes the most sense of that? Here's one answer from a gentleman who was not necessarily very friendly to organized religion. Paul Dirac was a famous mathematician, founder of quantum mechanics. In 1963, he said this, and I know this is kind of an old quote, but I think it still has some merit to it. So Paul Dirac, very famous mathematician, he said, "It seems to be one of the fundamental features of nature that fundamental physical laws are described in terms of a mathematical theory of, listen to this, of great beauty and power, needing quite a high standard of mathematics for one to understand it." Here's the point that matters. one. Now he's not a Christian. He's not even a believer. But he realizes you could make this assumption. One could perhaps describe the situation by saying that God is a mathematician of a very high order, and he used very advanced mathematics in constructing the universe. So this abstract concept of math seems to have more going on than just the physical material world can explain. All right, maybe you hated all of that because you hate math. I apologize for putting you through the trauma. Let's go to something that I think probably everybody likes a little bit more than math, and that's music. How about music for a change? Yeah, all right. So music, I don't think this goes, I'm also not like a very skilled musician, but I think this is a true statement that nobody's going to argue with. Music is like a language. It conveys emotion and meaning without actually using words. And one of the clearest ways to see that, or I guess to hear that, is actually to consider some of the iconic scenes from cinema with their music. So I'm going to give you a couple examples of that. So I want you to watch a couple things here and just see how the music changes or affects the meaning of the scene. So we'll start with this very first scene. Very iconic intro. It's one of the intros of probably the most famous villain in all of movie history, Darth Vader. So hopefully I've got this volume turned up enough. Just listen to the theme of music that comes with his intro and see how it's conveying meaning here. That was very hard to keep a straight face when I knew that was coming. When I found that video, I just laughed out loud so hard. It totally changed the mood of the scene, right? You thought you knew what was coming, and maybe you could argue like, yeah, the only reason that music is ominous because I know Darth Vader's coming. Well, as soon as you hear that other music, it changed the whole meaning of the scene. All right, that's a funny thing, but let me show you one more clip just to drive this home that's not funny. This is going to be a scene, one of my most favorite scenes from my favorite movies, The Lord of the Rings, of course, from The Return of the King. It's a scene where a great army, you don't have to know the story, a great army is about to charge against an enemy that is encamped against one of their cities. And what I want you to do, I want you to see this scene without music and then see this scene with the music and just see how different it is. Now, just disclaimer here, there's nothing graphic, nothing like that. There's going to be some arrows shot and some horses are going to fall. No real horses were harmed in the filming of these scenes. All right, here we go. First, no music. And you're just, it's going to be awkward. Just, it's okay. No music. And then you'll go to music.
For Elingus!
All right, just bear with me. It's all right, music. You might wonder why I'm lingering on this. I don't know about you, but when I see it with the music, I want to hop on a horse and like join King Theoden in battle. You saw that one guy at the end that's like charging. It's because he's hearing the music. It's got to be the only reason he's so excited about it. Music has a way of changing the meaning of something. And the question I'm trying to get us to ask is, why is that the case? Music, people speak of it as this feeling of transcendence. Like I'm being connected to something beyond just this physical and material universe. For example, somebody who said this was Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs was obviously you know who he was, but he was very good friends with Yo-Yo Ma, world-renowned cellist, who he asked him to play at his wedding, and he couldn't do it. But eventually, he finally came to his house, and he played some Bach on his 1733 Stradivarius. And after he played, Steve Jobs, in tears, looked at Yo-Yo Ma and said this to him. He said, "You playing is the best argument I've ever heard for the existence of God, because I don't really believe a human alone can do this." Now, the dominant scientific theory behind why music affects us like that is that it's some kind of mechanism that we have developed over time through evolution to help us better survive as a species. In a lot of ways, that could be explained. But to be honest with you, all of that is speculative. It's all a guess. And if it's true, and if it's true that our experience of music is simply just neurons firing to help us survive, then what it means is that music, the experience of music, is not actually real. It's an illusion. It's just an illusion to help us survive. That's one way of understanding music. And what it does is rob it of its power. But what if there was another way of understanding music? What if our experience of it couldn't be explained by scientific theories alone? J.R.R. Tolkien, who wrote The Lord of the Rings, and C.S. Lewis, both of them devout Christians, and really the forefathers of modern fantasy in our time, they actually viewed music as something that came from the heart and mind of God himself. So in their respective books, The Lord of the Rings, The Chronicles of Narnia, they actually have scenes, in the Silmarillion for Tolkien's case, they have scenes where the creation of their worlds actually happen by divine beings singing the world into existence. And the point I want to make to you is, what if music was more like that? What if music was an echo of or a window into a divine world? What if it was more like a divine language? If you hold up those two things, maybe it's just chemicals firing in our brain to help us survive, or maybe it's actually an echo of a world beyond this one. Which one actually makes more sense of your experience? Which one actually gives it more meaning? I lingered on that one especially because I think it's such a powerful, it goes beyond arguments and proofs to something we all know intuitively. There's something else beyond that. That's the second non-physical reality. The third non-physical reality will be much quicker because I don't think it needs as much explaining, and that's love. Love. We've got math, we've got music, we've got... So maybe you don't like math, and maybe you don't even listen to a lot of music. Everybody has had experience with love. And here's the question I want you to consider very quickly. Is the love that you feel for a friend or a parent or a spouse or a child, is that love only a physiological reaction completely explainable by chemistry and biological evolution? Is that all it is? Or is it something beyond this physical and material world, something real outside of you and independent of you? Which one actually makes more sense of your experience? What the Christian story says is that we were created by a God of love, and that love is actually at the core of reality, and that love is actually eternal because God himself actually is love in his essence. Because what Christianity says is that from eternity, before any of this was ever created, God existed as a Trinity, Father, Son, and Spirit, always loving each other. The Christian story actually says that love is meaningful. It's not just something that's happening in your brain or in your chemistry. Which one makes more sense? So now we've got all six of these things here. With the first three, it is possible for you to say, all right, I'll grant you all of those, but science just hasn't figured out an explanation for it yet, but it still probably will. I'm not going to make the leap to God. I'll just wait for science to catch up. And if that's where you're coming from, that's a fair response. If you apply that same logic to the other three non-physical realities, if you say one day science will completely explain our experience of math, music, and love, because right now it hasn't, but one day science will explain completely our experience of math, music, and love, then what you've done then is rob them of their meaning and their power. We would be impoverishing those things. We would ultimately be living in a world much smaller and more dull and less enchanted. And can we live with that reality? Let me tell you a story to kind of drive home what I'm trying to say there. So in the Chronicles of Narnia, the Silver Chair, the main characters in the book are imprisoned in this underground kind of fortress that's ruled by this evil sorceress. And she's trying to make the main characters believe that there actually is no world above ground at all. They just left from the above ground world and now they're underground. But she's trying to use her sorcery to make them think there is no above ground world. There's no sun, there's no sky, there's no such thing as lions, there's certainly no such thing as the lion, Aslan, who's the ruler of that universe. So Puddleglum, who you see here in this picture, who's like the goofiest character in the whole story, he breaks the witch's spell by saying this to the sorceress. And I think this is a powerful way of trying to say what I just said. Suppose, he says to the sorceress, suppose we have only dreamed or made up all those things, trees and grass and sun and moon and stars and Aslan himself, then all I can say is that in that case, the made-up things seem a good deal more important than the real ones. Suppose this black pit of a kingdom of yours is the only world. Well, it strikes me as a pretty poor one. And that's a funny thing when you come to think of it. We're just babies making up a game, if you're right. But four babies playing a game can make a play world which licks your real world hollow. If math and music and love can be completely explained with physical and material causes, can be completely explained by science, then those of us who actually believe those things are real and bigger than that, we have then created an imaginary world greater than the real world. But what the Christian story says is no, the real world actually is enchanted. I think one of the problems we see in our culture today is so many people are disillusioned and disenchanted with the world. But Christianity comes along and says, no, the real world is for lack of a better word, the real world is magical. There is more to this world than actually meets the eye, more to it than we can explain with science alone. All right. That is the end of the first part, which is the positive evidence for my claim that the Christian story of creation is true and better than the alternatives. Now let's turn our attention. So now that we see all those realities that I put before you, I'm asking you to determine for yourself which story do you think makes the most sense. Now let's consider three common objections against this story that I've been telling you. So let's defend the faith here a little bit. And then, so I'm going to share these common objections with you. If you think that there are other better objections that I didn't bring up, of course, I would say bring those up during the Q&A session. But I really did try to land on what I think are the most common objections against what we've been talking about. So objection number one, aren't faith and science opposed to each other? Aren't faith and science opposed to each other? I've heard this question in some form or another more than once. And here is my very nuanced answer. No. And I say that kind of tongue in cheek there. Let me elaborate on why I think the answer is no. There is a misunderstanding that science as we understand it today, what you would call the scientific method, this systematic way of understanding the world by observing it and measuring it and testing it and then repeating that process. That whole way of viewing the world, some people believe that actually developed as a reaction against religion and faith. Religion and faith were taking us this way, and science came along and said, no, we're going this way. So one common way that people will phrase this is something like this. People used to believe Zeus controlled the weather because they didn't know any better, but then science explained it, so we don't need Zeus. You've probably heard something like that before. That is really not an accurate history of the development of the scientific method. That is not actually how it happened. That does not describe the relationship between the Christian faith and science. The scientific way of understanding the world that we still benefit from today, it's really the air that we breathe in our culture, that really began and exploded and grew with this time period in history that historians call the Scientific Revolution from about 1500 to 1700, located in Europe and then spreading outward. So there's this Cambridge historian named Joseph Needham who looked at this period in time, and he asked a very famous question about it. He said, why there and why then? In other words, we had seen plenty of civilizations outside of Europe and even before 1500 that had pretty remarkable understandings of the world. They had achieved some pretty remarkable technological achievements. So think about like the Egyptian pyramids. The Chinese had invented the compass and gunpowder, Roman roads and aqueducts. The Incas down in South America had sophisticated irrigation systems and so on and so forth. Why did those civilizations in those times not give rise to this scientific revolution, this systematic way of understanding the world? Why did it happen in Europe at that time? And the answer that Needham arrives at, the key answer that he and other historians arrive at, the thing that was different about Europe during that time is the Christian worldview. The Christian worldview that was central to Europe during that time was really the key to laying the foundation for the scientific revolution. In other words, here's what Christians believed during that time and what Christians still believe today. Number one, they believe the world's not an accident. It's not haphazard. It's not random. There are laws. It's ordered and it's regular. Therefore, we actually can study it. We actually can make theories. We actually can measure it. But they also believe that human beings were fallible. We're not perfect. And so as much as we try to understand it, we have to repeat those tests and challenge those tests and re-measure and all those kinds of things. All of that gave rise to this scientific way of understanding the world. This is also why so many of the great scientists that came out of the scientific revolution, names that you're going to recognize, were devoted professing Christians to one degree or another. For example, Galileo Galilei, who is famous, of course, for inventing the telescope. He advocated for the sun being at the center of the universe and not the earth. And then you've got Isaac Newton, who discovered the law of gravity, also invented calculus. Johann Kepler discovered the laws of planetary motion. Robert Boyle is the forefather of modern chemistry. These men did not pursue science despite their faith. They actually pursued science because of their faith. And even today, even though I know this is kind of a misperception in the world, even today, many scientists are devoted Christians whose faith, they would say, actually establishes and encourages their scientific endeavors. I could show you lots of these people. I'll just give you one example. This is Rosalind Picard. I think I'm saying her last name correctly. She is the director of effective computing at MIT, probably one of the world's most prestigious research universities. She actually helped develop an AI program recently to help detect seizures in people. She was a very staunch atheist when she was young, but then as a young adult, she became a Christian. Recently, she was in an interview, and she was asked if she ever found it difficult to reconcile her Christian faith with science. And the way she answered that was first by saying no, just flat out no. And then here's how she elaborated on that. It's going to sound exactly like everything I was just saying. She said, throughout history, there have been great scientists who are also very devout Christians, people like Isaac Newton, who wrote significantly more about his Christian faith than about science. You could also argue that the whole enterprise of looking for order and meaning in the universe presupposes that it's there, that it's not just random, purposeless, meaningless forces floating around with no origin. She's saying exactly the same thing I'm saying. The reason that the scientific method exists like it does today and the scientific revolution even happened was because it was embedded in and grew up out of the Christian faith tradition. And that's why so many of those early scientists were devoted Christians. So Are faith and science opposed to each other? No, they're not. That's not the way that it started, and that's not the way that it has to be today. That's objection number one. Objection number two. Doesn't the multiverse explain the origins and fine-tuning of the universe? Doesn't the multiverse explain the origins and fine-tuning of the universe? Again, a very nuanced answer here. No. Again, let me elaborate. So at the very beginning of this teaching, we had those three physical realities. Number one was the universe had a definite beginning. Number two, it's fine-tuned for life. And I told you there's not really a satisfactory scientific explanation for that. But that doesn't mean scientists aren't trying. And it's fair to try. That's what science does. It tries to discover and understand and explain things. Probably the most widely talked about theory that tries to explain those two things is this idea of what's called the multiverse. That's a colloquial way of talking about these theories. The Marvel superhero comics and movies have made this a very popular idea in our wider culture lately. But here's what it is. And if you've never heard of the multiverse, here's what it is in layman's terms. What it says is that this universe we live in is actually one of many, and maybe even an infinite number of other universes that we can't get to. It's not like we could fly far enough in space to get to. We can't get to them. They exist in parallel to each other. And the way that our universe started is one of those other universes seeded it. One of the other universes started it. And the reason it's so fine-tuned for life is because, well, there's an infinite number of them. It was bound to happen sooner or later. That's the theory. There's three problems with it. Number one, if you want to write this down, you can. I don't have slides for it. Here's the first problem with that whole idea of the multiverse. Even if that could be proven, let's say it could be proven without a shadow of a doubt, it still would not explain how everything got started. It would only punt that question farther away. In other words, if there is a multiverse that explained how this universe got started, it wouldn't explain how all the other universes got started. We would just have to keep punting that question farther and farther and farther away. So it really doesn't answer the question we're trying to answer. That's the first problem. Second problem, and this is bigger than that, there's no actual hard, direct evidence for this theory. It's purely theoretical and speculative. That's why in 2019, the Scientific American had an article that said, "Multiverse theories are bad for science." So let me ask you this. If your two choices on the table are, you can believe in an infinite number of universes that somehow created this one, but there's no real evidence for that. You can believe in that, or you can believe in a single supernatural creator. The question I would ask you is, which of those answers is actually a simpler answer? And you could disagree with me on that, but here's how theologian Rebecca McLaughlin states the issue here. The idea of a creator God does not sound quite so crazy when you realize that the best current alternative is the existence of an infinite number of parallel universes. The point is, yeah, we jump to the solution that there's a supernatural God. Scientists are having to jump to other things that they can't directly prove either. We're all dealing with a little bit of mystery here, and that's okay. So I told you there were three problems. That was the second problem. Third problem is this idea that maybe there's another universe that exists outside of ours. If that were proven true, that actually wouldn't hurt the case for Christianity. It would actually only bolster it. Here's what I mean by that. Think about the Christian biblical concept of heaven. Heaven in the Bible is not like a place you can get to if you fly far enough in our galaxy, like maybe it's on a planet somewhere. That's not what heaven is. Heaven is an alternate realm, an alternate world. Perhaps one way of saying that is another universe. The Bible talks about angels and demons that we can't see but are actually there. It even calls them like the prince of the power of the air. The idea there is that there's this alternate dimension. So even if there is this speculative other world or universe, all that would do is further bolster the Christian story. It really wouldn't take away from it. So that is objection number two. The multiverse does not explain really the origins and fine-tuning of the universe. Last objection, and maybe you're waiting for this one. Doesn't the theory of evolution explain the origins of life? Doesn't the theory of evolution explain the origins of life? And again, you guessed it, my short answer is no, but hear me out. Hear me out on this. I'm going to try to nuance this carefully. At most, the theory of biological evolution by natural selection, Darwin's famous theory, which has been revised and updated and all that, at most, what it can do is explain the survival of life, not the arrival of life. Say that again. At most, the theory of biological evolution can explain the survival of life, not the arrival of life. It can explain, at most, how we evolved from lower, less complex forms, but it can't explain how the first form got there in the first place. That's the problem we talked about a few minutes ago about where did the first digital code come from? Where did the first DNA come from? The theory of biological evolution, even the theory of chemical evolution, doesn't have a satisfactory answer for that. But you'll notice I kept saying the phrase at most and at best. And here's why. Because in recent decades, more and more scientists, and I'm talking about like reputable scientists from Oxford, from Cambridge, from the University of Chicago, like reputable scientists are starting to see flaws and gaps and a lack of explanatory power, even as evolution tries to explain how one species will change into another. So maybe evolution can't explain where the first one came from, but certainly evolution can explain how this species changed into this species. Scientists are more and more starting to see that actually there are flaws and gaps even in that version of evolution. For starters, let me just throw this out there. Sometimes you will hear or you'll see online people say, look, this is proof of evolution. And usually what they mean by that is what we call microevolution. Let me show you an article that popped up on my phone the other day because the algorithm knows that I've been looking at this stuff. This is actually a screenshot of the article. It says, do you want proof? You want modern proof of evolution? Look at the elephants of Mozambique. So what you would expect when you read this article is there must be elephants in Mozambique that are evolving into another species. But that's not what's happening. If you read the article, what it says is that over the years, because of poachers, they've noticed that most female elephants now are being born without tusks. They've adapted to their environment through random mutations, and so certain characteristics have changed. That's what we call microevolution. You can actually observe that just like this. But that's a far cry from one species changing into another species. But the title would make you think that this is solid proof of the entire theory, and it's kind of misleading because the inherent problem in the grander theory of evolution, what you call macroevolution, this idea that one species can completely evolve into a higher level species, the biggest problem there is you can never observe that. By definition of the theory, it takes millions and billions of years. Therefore, it will never be observable in real time, never be measurable in real time, never be testable in real time. And let's go back to the whole DNA problem. The problem that we've been discovering ever since 1953, when that DNA code was discovered, and we realized this is really like a complex software code, the problem that evolutionary biologists began to discover is that how do you take a lower life form with this amount of code in it and get to this higher life form with this amount of code in it? Let me give you a metaphor. How many of you remember MS-DOS? All right, got some MS-DOS fans in here. Very low-level form of computing where you had to know certain commands and stuff if you wanted to do anything. And then, eventually, it grew and you had Windows 98. Anybody remember the blue screen of death on Windows 98? I was blue screened of death many a time. And then, of course, we're now at Windows 11. Much more enhanced, much more sophisticated, much more complicated. If there's Mac users in here, I apologize if I'm offending you there. Here's the point I'm trying to make. How in the world did computer programmers move from MS-DOS to Windows 11? Here's what they didn't do. They didn't just monkey around with the code that was already there. We'll just move some code around and we'll get to Windows 11. No. They had to input a whole bunch of new code. And what evolutionary biologists are coming up against is that exact problem. The problem of getting from this life form to this life form isn't just we'll mess around with some of the DNA. It needs a whole lot more new, sophisticated DNA. Where's that coming from? How's it being input? And again, I don't want you to take my word for it. There are lots of reputable scientists that are beginning to push back and say that the current theory of evolution needs at least significant revisions, if not a whole new theory. And if you want some of those names and I can direct you to them, I will. But let me just give you one guy that I think is really interesting. His name is David Galanter. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly or not. He's a Yale University professor of computer science, so he knows about digital code. He was a victim of the Unabomber. You remember that, the Unabomber? He actually like his hand is like all in a glove and stuff now, and he had major trauma to his chest. I just found that interesting. He wrote a book in 1991 that predicted the World Wide Web. So he's a smart guy. And he knows a lot about digital code. He wrote an article in 2019 for the Claremont Review of Books. And the title of the article was Giving Up Darwin, A Fond Farewell to a Beautiful and Brilliant Theory. Let me read you a quote from that. I'm going to read you part of it, and then I'll put the rest of it on the screen. He said, there's no reason to doubt that Darwin successfully explained the small adjustments by which an organism adapts to local circumstances. Changes to fur density or wing style or beak shape, or kind of like elephants not having tusks anymore. Darwin explained that. Yet there are many reasons to doubt whether he can answer the hard questions and explain the big picture. Not the fine-tuning of existing species, but the emergence of new ones. The origin of species is exactly what Darwin cannot explain. Go to that's right there in the middle. The origin of species is exactly what Darwin cannot explain. And then here's kind of a really strong statement here, but I think it's worth hearing. Darwinism, and he's not talking about for everybody, but for a lot of people that are tried and true and will accept no challenges to it, Darwinism is no longer just a scientific theory, but the basis of a worldview and an emergency replacement religion for the many troubled souls who need one. Ooh, ouch. Last thing I'll say here. I want to be clear here. I want to just kind of make a caveat. I'm arguing that the current theory of biological and even chemical evolution is not the ultimate final explainer of all the origins and complexities of life. It can't explain it all. There are still holes in our knowledge, there are gaps, there are flaws, and many good scientists are looking for other solutions here, even if they're not looking for a supernatural solution. But if you're out there, if you're listening to me online or you're here and you've studied this more than I told you I'm not a scientist, if you've studied evolution more than I have and you still find it to be, in some form or another, a compelling theory of how life grows and changes and all that, let me say this clearly to you. You can still, hear me out, because some people might find this controversial, you can still follow Jesus and believe in the creation and redemption story in Scripture. Those things don't necessarily have to be at odds. What I mean by that is followers of Jesus can agree to disagree about certain aspects of evolution while still agreeing on the essentials of the faith. There are actually many devoted Christians in the world of science who still accept some tenets of evolution by natural selection. I don't have time to delve into that there. If you're interested in seeing what I'm talking about, there is a resource that I put a note beside on the very back page that's all about how you might reconcile some parts of evolution with the Christian faith. I don't necessarily hold all those positions myself. What I'm saying is you don't have to throw out Christianity just because you accept some forms of evolution. This is not one of those primary issues. All right, so we've looked at all of our objections at this point. Let's now come to our conclusion, and we'll wrap it up and do a Q&A. Covered a lot of ground, and I realize it's probably overwhelming. My point was not for you to memorize all this stuff, but to try to feel the force of all the evidence in favor of this story of a personal God. And here's how I would summarize everything. There are some really big, important things in life that science cannot adequately explain and give meaning to. But the point I'm making is not that the story that science tells is false, just that it's an incomplete story. We should not treat science like it's the whole book. We should treat it more like it's a chapter or an appendix in the book. And my claim is that Christianity, the story of Christianity, gives us more of the story than science does. It actually gives science itself meaning. So the story of Christianity actually makes more sense of the world, gives it more meaning. It is true and it is better. So since I'm using that metaphor of stories and books, let me give you one final quote that continues that metaphor. You're probably wondering why we haven't used Albert Einstein yet. I wanted to save the best for last. Probably the most famous scientist of the last 100 years. Just before his 50th birthday, he was asked in an interview if he believed in God. And here's his answer. He said, "I'm not an atheist. The problem involved is too vast for our limited minds. We are in the position of a little child entering a huge library filled with books in many languages. The child knows someone must have written those books. It does not know how. It does not understand the languages in which they are written. The child dimly suspects a mysterious order in the arrangement of the books, but doesn't know what it is. That, it seems to me, is the attitude of even the most intelligent human being toward God." The Christian response to that quote is yes and amen, but here's what, if I could talk to Einstein when he said that, I would say, but what if, in your analogy, what if the author of the books and the librarian who arranged them, what if they were one and the same person? And then what if that person, that author-librarian, actually entered into the library, not just to help you understand the library, but actually to have a personal relationship with you? That's who we believe Jesus is. I told you I wasn't going to start with Scripture, but I have to end with Scripture. Everything I just tried to say, everything that Einstein's hinting at, I think can be found right here in Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 through 3. Last thing I'm going to read to you. Here's what it said. Long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. And other places in the Scripture say He spoke to us in the universe and the stars and the galaxies. He spoke to us in created world. But in these last days, He's spoken to us by His Son Jesus, whom He appointed the heir of all things, through whom also He created the world. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of His nature. And He, Jesus, upholds the universe by the word of His power. That same Jesus, upholding the universe, after making purification for sins, sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high. That is the Christian story. Not simply that there is a creator of the cosmos who made it and upholds it, but that that same creator entered into His creation to die and rise again so that He could have a relationship with us. Let me pray with you. Heavenly Father, thank You for Jesus Christ, the one through whom You made everything. I'm reminded of what Proverbs chapter 8 talks about, how You created the world in wisdom. And then the New Testament says Jesus is the wisdom of God. He's the one at the root of all of it. In Him, Scripture says, are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. Following Jesus is not to throw our minds outside and to forget pursuing scientific realism. Following Jesus is the foundation for understanding the universe if we follow Him appropriately. So my prayer tonight is not that we would have a lower view of science or a lower view of the natural world, but actually we would be more enchanted with it, that we would see more than just surface level. We'll see that it's pointing us to a world beyond this one, that the world is much bigger and much more magical and much more amazing than we could ever dream, because behind it is a God who loves us so much that He sent His own Son to become a human, to die and rise again in our place. May we all pursue a relationship with Him. You commanded us to seek You, and if we seek You with all our heart, we will find You. Your fingerprints are everywhere. You want us to find You. So my prayer is, if there's somebody here tonight that hasn't made that pursuit, that hasn't sought You and found You, that they would continue that search and that You would make Yourself real to them through the created world, but especially through Your Son, Jesus Christ. And I ask all this in His name. Amen. Amen. All right, before we take our five-minute break, let me just quickly remind you, we've covered the scientific evidence and objections. The next two class are moral evidence and objections, and then historical. So we have not built our entire case. Maybe you heard everything you said and said, okay, that's fine, I'm still not convinced. All right, keep coming back. We're just slowly building our case here to the next two classes. David, hit me with the first question.
First, can we actually give Anthony a hand?
Oh,
he's the one who did something tonight. Yeah.
Thanks, Dave.
Yeah, thank you as always. Great job, Anthony. Just want to remind you guys, we have some pre-written questions we don't want to let Anthony answer because he'll sound way smarter. So let's send them in. You can text them in. If you need the number, ask your neighbor. They probably wrote it down. But we do already have a couple questions in. So
perfect.
It's going to start hard.
All
so
right,
it says, right. The first question here is, what is the difference between science and naturalism? It's a good question.
That is a good question. So we talked about naturalism at the previous class, and I defined it as the belief that all that exists is only the natural physical material world. There's nothing outside of it. It's a closed system. The difference between that and science is that science as it should be practiced is not trying to make claims about whether or not there is a world outside of this one. It's just trying to study the world that we have, and it leaves those questions to like philosophy and religion and to metaphysics, but it's not making definitive statements that there can be nothing but this. Naturalism goes farther and says, no, this is all that there is. So science is just trying to stay in its lane, I would say. There's another phrase that's similar to naturalism, which is scientism. That's when you take the practice of science and you basically turn it into a philosophy and a worldview. That now science is, you've probably heard people, especially during the COVID pandemic, talk about the science. It almost became a mantra of almost like a religion more than just a way of like viewing the world. And here's one way you can know when somebody's treating science more like a religion and a worldview than actual science. It's when they get really upset if you challenge their view or try to push back on it. Science was made to be challenged. One of the tenets of the scientific method is a theory that you make has to be falsifiable. In other words, there must be some theoretical way of trying to prove that your theory is false. And if you don't like that, if you say, no, you can't question my theory, then we moved into the realm of naturalism and religion and worldview, like dogmatic fundamental religion. That would be my way of distinguishing those two things. You can have science without taking it all the way to scientism. Any thoughts on that, Dave?
Yeah, I think that's helpful. So you're basically saying naturalism is a worldview, Whereas science can be done with people from all different worldviews because it's just studying the
science
world.
Is a method, exactly. That's okay, the way method, I would say. Yeah. A systematic way of understanding and improving the world. But it doesn't have to turn into a dogmatic worldview. Yeah.
Cool.
Yep.
Thanks. This next question might be one of those ones that falls outside your scientific realm, but I'm going to ask it because it is... I think it's relevant for the thing for the actual content for tonight, and it's one we can say, good question, we'll answer later. So caveats before I ask it. How does what we've learned tonight respond to more recent discoveries in cellular evolutionary theory like epigenetics?
Do I know anything about epigenetics? No. I'll just flat out say I have no answer for that. The only answer I would give is, number one, I'll look into it, but number two, if I had to point you in a direction to begin looking for like what's a solid Christian response to that, like an actual solid Christian response, I would start with the Discovery Institute or Reasons to Believe. Both of those are led by gentlemen that are highly trained, very respectable scientists that are even respected outside the world of Christendom. Dr. Stephen Meyer wrote The Signature in the Cell, I think, and Darwin's Doubt. And there have been solid, like, agnostic scientists who have read those books and said, you know what? Like, I don't necessarily agree with his final conclusion that there's a supernatural creator, but the science here is solid, and we would do well to take it seriously. So he's the Discovery Institute, and I think Hugh Ross is a very smart astronomer that heads up Reasons to Believe. That's where I would start looking for an answer to that, because I don't know what it is, but 100% positive that those guys would. And so, good question. I just don't know. Yep.
Yeah, so that's you. Come talk to us after.
Yeah.
Next question. So the Bible describes God as creating the world in 6 days, resting on the seventh day. How does that fit in with the current scientific evidence regarding the age of the universe?
I heard some hmms out there. I'll try to make this as brief as possible. So... there has been disagreement, debate, looking into that question of what does the early accounts of Genesis creation actually mean, almost since the early centuries of the Christian church. This is not a new question. For example, St. Augustine in the 4th century wrote a commentary on Genesis. And in that commentary, he scratched his head about the 6 days of creation and said that there are things in the text itself that maybe imply this wasn't meant by the original author to be taken as 6 literal 24-hour days. So Augustine actually left open the possibility that maybe it's not talking about literal 24-hour days. Maybe it's talking about like long ages of time. I don't think he reached a conclusion on that. Here's why that's important. Augustine didn't know the theory of evolution. He didn't have modern technology. He was not making those conclusions about Genesis because science was like corrupting his mind or something like that. He was looking at the text and saying the text itself leads me to a different position. My point is that you don't have to read Genesis as though the earth was created in 6 literal days and therefore maybe the earth is 6,000 years old. I think almost any reputable scientist in any university would disagree with that conclusion. Let me just tell you where I'm coming at personally. and there's room to disagree. Let me be clear. This is not a primary issue. People treat this like it's a primary issue. This is not a primary issue. This is not an Apostles' Creed issue. Did Jesus die and rise from the dead? We have room to disagree here. When I read Genesis and I look at what's actually in the text, I have a hard time thinking it's actually talking about six literal 24-hour days. There's different uses of the Hebrew word yom, day. Even in the first chapter, there's obviously different ways to use it metaphorically and literally. There's very clearly elements of style and poetry and parallelism. There's all kinds of hints in that first chapter that maybe we're not supposed to take this literally as six 24-hour days. But last thing I'll say about this, even if you do, let's say that you're a Christian and you take it as six literal 24-hour days. That is fine. You can still hold that position and believe that the earth and the universe are billions or millions of years old. You can still believe in an old earth. Here's why I would say that. There is potentially a gap between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2. So 1:1 says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Almost like a blanket statement. In the beginning. There's no time frame there. He just did it, and it's left open to how long it took. Verse 2 is, now the earth was formless and without void, which gives the impression that now God's going to start shaping the earth, but it was already created, maybe in billions of years. So there's a way of still reading the days as literally 24-hour days and still holding to an old earth. The other thing I would say there is we're not told how long Adam and Eve were in the garden. So maybe they were created and they lived for a really long time before they sinned. My point is there are lots of ways you can reconcile the Genesis account with current science and still be faithful to the Genesis account. But just kind of sum that up, just keep in mind, like, Genesis was not originally written to try to be a science textbook. It certainly may have scientific implications, but it was written to tell us the story about God and his purposes for his people that would ultimately culminate in the seed of Abraham, Jesus Christ. So that's my haven't looked at that question ever before response.
That one was off the paper, so. No, but I really appreciate the nuance there, and even just the importance of saying, like, hey, sometimes we hold that up as like a house of cards, mm-hmm. issue as far as how old the earth is, but the resurrection is what Paul said. Hey, if
exactly.
that didn't
right.
happen,
right.
this doesn't matter. He didn't say if the earth isn't this old, that doesn't matter. So I really appreciate the differentiation.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Still
no more text questions. So if you have a question, text it in.
All right.
I'm hitting refresh over here. But the next one we can go to is, what would you say to someone who's become skeptical of science in general and just distrustful of scientific experts? So how would you advise them to approach the world they live in? So kind of maybe the Christian who's very skeptical of science, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think that's increasingly, I see that in certain segments of the church, especially since the COVID pandemic and things of that nature. I'll come at this at two angles. In one sense, let me say it's healthy to be skeptical to a certain degree because that's kind of the point of the scientific method, right? You observe, you measure, you test, you repeat, and you challenge, and you push, and all this. I was just talking to Andy, who works for NASA, and he was telling me, like the scientists at NASA will say, we figured it out, and then they'll, like, get a better telescope that looks farther, and like, oh, we've got more questions now. That's science. Science is progressing and changing, and of course, there are some things in science that are much more settled, like the law of gravity. That's pretty settled, but you know what we don't know about gravity? We know the law, but we don't actually know what it is. Like, Einstein has a theory of relativity, maybe, that space-time is curved, but there's still questions about gravity, and people push back on that. So there are certain segments of science that are very established and certain other ones that are not established, and it's okay to be skeptical to a certain degree. That's actually scientific to be that way. And I said this before, if you come up against somebody that won't let you push against their scientific theory, it may be that you're dealing more with a worldview and a philosophy and maybe even a dogmatic religion than you're actually dealing with a scientific theory. The other thing there about being skeptical is we live in the internet age where anybody with no pedigree can put anything on the internet. So be skeptical. Please, please don't believe everything that you read on the internet. Like, we do actually need, like, respectable, qualified, trained experts in these areas. We can't just doubt everything. That's not healthy either. So that's the last thing today. Don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. And all of your being skeptical of certain things, go back to what we said about where science started. Remember, science, the scientific method, was birthed out of the Christian world view. It's a gift of God. Think about all the good things we've gotten from science. You've got the polio and smallpox vaccines. You've got MRI machines, air conditioning, electric power, cars. We could keep going and going. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. So if I had to summarize it, you can be skeptical without becoming a skeptic. That would be like, and that's a tough line to like walk sometimes. I don't know if there's an easy way to do that. You just got to be aware of yourself. Don't become a skeptic about everything. So that's, you got thoughts about that, Dave?
No, I think you answered that really well, almost like you knew it was going to be asked. No, we actually did get another question texted in, so thank you, whoever that was. So of all the arguments for the existence of God, cosmological, teleological, ontological, epistemological, lots of big words here, types of arguments about the existence of God, which do you find the most significant and effective, or is it some kind of combination of those arguments?
Good question. I really like the teleological, the fine-tuning argument that we talked about, because it doesn't rely, like some of the other arguments for God's existence rely on just like philosophical proofs, like you have two premises and a conclusion, and people can just always say, I don't agree with that premise. The problem with the fine-tuning argument is, and I'm virtually no scientist, and maybe somebody would push back on me that knows more than I, but my understanding is virtually no reasonable scientist disagrees that the constants of our universe and the certain quantities are finely tuned. Like almost nobody disagrees with that. So it really begs the question, how is that possible? And I don't see a lot of like compellingness in the theories that actually exist, like the multiverse theory and stuff. Like I said, that's very speculative. It's at least as speculative as believing in a supernatural God. I would argue there's more reason to believe in a supernatural God. Christopher Hitchens, have anybody heard of Christopher Hitchens? He was also a very famous atheist, one of the new atheists, recently died of cancer, very aggressively not happy with religion. He wrote books like against religion, but he did a debate series with a Christian, and they had some behind the scenes, like they would ride together in the car to the debates they were going to. And I believe he was asked, just kind of in personal conversation, which of these do you find most compelling from the Christian argument? And he said the fine-tuning argument. He does find that one hard to like reconcile with his atheism. So that's probably the one I would lean on.
Yeah, I would just to say, you know, you might find that depending on who you're talking to, or even for yourself, you might find a different one more significant. They're all worth looking into. I would agree with you. I actually am taking a class right now, and I had to pick one, and I picked that one as well.
Nice.
Just a fun fact with that, I was saying, well, some people will say, well, couldn't it happen? You know, people win the lottery. That's pretty unlikely, but it happens, right?
Yeah.
And it says, well, that's not really the best illustration for it. It'd be like being dealt a royal flush for several hundred hands in a row. So the same person for several hundred consecutive hands being dealt a royal flush, which if someone's dealt a royal flush twice in a row, you know intelligence was behind that. You're like, you're cheating. You know,
anybody ever had a royal flush? Has anybody ever in a poker game had a royal flush in this room?
You play played poker?
Wait a second. I'm just kidding. I'm joking. Both of us had that. Hey, you've really had a royal flush? Have you had two in a row? No. I've never heard of anybody.
Yeah.
So think of 100 of them. That's crazy.
So I love that as well, just as far as like things that are like unlikely happen, but that's not unlikely.
We're talking
that's
astronomically
impossible.
Unlikely. Yep. Cool. I also, just one last thing there. This wasn't listed in the things there. I really just love the arguments from like music and math and those kinds of things. Those to me are not as like clear as the science, but just more like compelling to my emotions. And I think that can be an argument for people to do. There are atheists who will say things like, I can't remember the name of the atheist. He's like, I began to question my agnosticism when I listened to Cat Stevens. I can't remember who that was. But like just that beauty, like I can't, like you're telling me that's just a chemical reaction in my brain. Like it just doesn't sit well with me. So that's another, I think, that's powerful. So cool. Yeah, go ahead.
We actually got a couple more that just came
in.
So
this is great.
Thank you guys for sending them in. Great. Sorry if we don't get to them. It's not because we don't like you. We're already at 8:31, so we got 4 minutes.
Yep.
So this next one says, what is the difference between how a Christian defines religion versus how an atheist or maybe a secularist would define it? That might be helpful maybe when talking to like a friend who is using the word religion. But
that's going to be hard to answer because it would just depend on the specific atheist and what they mean by that. Here's my attempt at an answer. I heard Neil deGrasse Tyson in an interview on a late night show one time say that he cannot be a person of faith. Neil deGrasse Tyson, a very famous astronomer that likes to go on late shows and talk about science. He says he's not a person of faith because faith is blind belief without evidence. I think a lot of agnostics and atheists believe that religion is blind belief without evidence. And Neil deGrasse Tyson is one of those people. But number one, they're just wrong about that assumption. That's not the Christian faith. The Christian faith is rooted in a historical event that actually has evidence. And it's rooted, and we just looked at a bunch of evidence. We don't believe in Jesus because, like, it's a leap of faith and no evidence. We actually believe there's evidence, and because of that evidence, it compels us to trust Jesus. Some of that evidence is much more metaphysical, but some of it is very concrete. So that's probably one way that the atheist would define religion in a different way than I would. Any thoughts about that?
I think that's one of the main reasons conversations are more useful than just like a Twitter post or X post, because then you have the opportunity to actually define terms and actually, you know, talk about, well, you know, you're talking about religion, you're just clumping all religions together. That's very different than Christianity. It's very unique. So it kind of takes away the uniqueness of even each religion.
Great point.
It would take more of a conversation, I think. Here's a good question that just came in. This might be the last one. Probably is. Do you believe there's a possibility to be too open-minded and progressive towards science as a Christian and accidentally push past the boundaries of our human understanding that God has put into place? So can we be too curious?
I mean, I guess the answer is maybe, but let me answer it this way. I do not believe that if you actually pursue science through the scientific method, what you can observe and measure and test and repeat, that you will ever come up against anything that disproves Christianity. That's how solidly I believe in the Christian story. And if this thing is real, if Jesus is real and God the Father and God the Spirit are real, we should never feel worried that we're going to investigate this natural world so far that it proves it wrong. If that's what we're worried about, then Christianity is on shaky foundations. And I just do not believe Christianity is on those shaky foundations. So I guess my short answer is no. If you approach science the right way, then I don't think you'll ever go so far that you'll get away from God. I think actually you'll just find yourself believing more and more and more in God. And a lot of scientists that are much smarter than me have said that. Their pursuit of science has only deepened their faith. It is not, just like Rosalind Picard, it has not actually challenged their faith. Yeah.
Right on time.
We're out of time.
Great final word.
Man, great, great. Well, thank you. Thank you, Dave. Thank you for all your questions. If you did send some in that we get into, I will try to respond. Otherwise, come back for the next class in November. Thank you so much for showing up tonight. Please drive safe, and please come back on Sunday.